Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Welcome to Murder
and Mimosas,
a true crime podcast brought to you by a mother and daughter duo,
bringing you murder stories with a mimosas in hand.
Just a quick disclaimer before we get started. Our show is Murder and Mimosas. It's a true crime podcast. This means that we do discuss crimes, including but not limited to disappearances, murder, and sexual assault. All our episodes are told with the respect of the victims and the victims' families in mind. We strive to ensure that we provide factual information, but some information is more verifiable than others. With that, grab your mimosas and let's dive in.
Welcome back. I'm Shannon.
And I'm Danica.
Today, we're going to cover a serial rapist and murderer, Joji Arbara. So grab your mimosas, you sit while we share. Imagine being in a foreign country and getting a call that your sister, who is also there, is in the hospital and her condition is severe. That was the scary reality for Samantha Ridgway. Samantha had moved to Tokyo from Australia to teach English. In 1991, her 21-year-old sister, Parita, had come to join her in Japan, hoping to get a teaching job. Her real desire was to be an actress, and she was studying drama in Sydney before she had moved. She had student loans piling up, though, and had to be an adult and do the responsible thing before she could follow her dreams. Cartier realized all too quickly that getting a teaching job may not be in the cards, and she began to look for jobs, any jobs. But of course, she had bills. She began looking in the newspaper, like all of us ancient people used to do back in the day, and found one that looked promising as a hostess, which also paid incredibly well.
Okay, is there a reason a hostess job pays so well in Japan? That's like a minimum job, minimum wage job here in the States. And also, I mean, how well are we talking?
Okay, well, it's the same title, but not the same thing at all as what we have here. These were called hostess clubs that mostly Japanese businessmen frequented. And the hostess were there to make conversations with them, light their cigarettes, keep their drinks filled. And they could make up to $50 an hour, up to $400 a night. And this is in the early 90s, remind you.
Okay, not to be like a cynic, but is there sex involved?
No. Well, not in the club anyway. They have what is essentially a female manager that looks after the girls to make sure that they are not touched or come on to sexually in any way. In fact, if you are caught doing this, you are thrown out of the club indefinitely.
Okay, I guess I'm not getting like the appeal of like how they're making that much money. They're not strippers. They're not sex workers. They just refill their drinks like a waitress and chit-chat with them.
Yeah, and I don't get it either, but that was the job. I also need to say that most of these women were white women, and this was something that drew the Japanese men in for whatever reason. I don't know, some kind of fetish they had. But these men could pay them to go on dates with them, though, outside of the hostess club. And since they aren't in the club, we can't say for sure what is going on, you know, on these dates. Maybe you're just hired for a date. Maybe not.
So it's kind of like a escort type option is available.
That's available, but that's not the hostess job. But you can do that outside of the hostess job.
Okay.
So naturally, Carita's family was not thrilled with this new job. I mean, you and I are a little confused as to what it is, and it sounds like it could be a little sketchy, if we're being honest, but she's grown, so what can they do? So on Friday, February 14th, Carita and several other co-workers went on a date with several customers. That night after the date, an older man offered her a ride home that she accepted. Her friend was the one that saw her leave with this man. And Samantha received a message from her sister that she would not be home that weekend. Monday morning, Carita is rushed to the hospital and brought in by a man that says his name is Nishita. And they were on a date. And she's having a reaction to shellfish. Samantha fearfully rushes to the hospital when she's called, and she's told a man brought her in saying that Carita had eaten a raw oyster, which is now causing liver failure. Carita was never able to speak to her sister or parents. She was in and out of consciousness and unable to talk.
Okay, I eat oysters often, and I've never heard of it causing liver failure. And I'm just saying, we live in a landlocked state, so I know I'm not eating fresh oysters. This is a little wild to me.
Yeah, I know, right? I know he said she was having a reaction to shellfish, and I could never find in the sources if she even had an allergy to shellfish. I would think her sister would know that and question it, but Cardia would also know that and stay clear of any oysters, I would think, if you're like this severely allergic to shellfish.
Exactly. No one with a shellfish allergy is going to intentionally do that. Not to mention, it doesn't really sound like an allergic reaction to me.
This is Tracy.
This is Samantha.
This is The Suspended Sentence.
Grab your latte and join us as we enter season two, starting January 1st of 2024.
A year packed full of serial killers that you may or may not have ever heard of.
Thanks for being there.
Stay safe.
I'm right there with you. Cardia was having liver failure. She was in a coma and brain dead after only a few days in the hospital. Her family made the gut-wrenching decision to remove her from life support and let her go. There was an autopsy done, but the family was never given a copy, despite their efforts to get it. They had her cremated there in Japan. Samantha hasn't forgot this Nishita guy and asked the hospital for more information, which they have absolutely nothing. He does call Samantha a few times to ask about her sister's condition. This is the part that made me say, though. After she dies, he meets her family at a hotel. He tells them the whole oyster story, and then he gives them a diamond ring and a diamond necklace he said he had bought for Harita, and he says he loved her.
Wait a minute. Didn't they, like, meet for the first time that Friday? And, like, that's it?
From what I could gather, yes. And that's not all. He wants to pay her family 1 million yen to cover the funeral and travel costs. Looking it up, that is the equivalent to $6,755.75 in the States now. So the family declines. I mean, this is all so strange, right? But then Samantha tells him, yeah, I'll take it. So she's hoping this will get her a paper trail on this Nishita guy. But that got her nowhere. The family requests that the Tokyo police investigate her death in Nishita, but that fell on deaf ears, and they went to the Australian embassy for help and sadly got nowhere there also. So let's fast forward to May of 2000. So 21-year-old Lucy Blackman and her friend Louise Phillips decide they're going to move to Japan to work as hostesses. Both women are from England. Lucy had worked at a French investment bank and as an assistant to the traders there. She joined the traders at bars after work, and she wanted to dress the part, which all of this costs money, right? And this racked up some serious credit card debt. Then she got a job with the British Airways as a flight attendant, and she had hopes of seeing the world with this job. The job turned out to not be quite as fun as she hoped, and she had a friend that boasted about how much her sister was making as a hostess in Japan. So this was Lucy's new adventure. But Cartia, her family wasn't really thrilled with this job either. She told them this was pretty much like being a flight attendant, but not in the air. Again, she's grown, so what can they do? Plus, the money was good, and she needed to pay off her debt. Both girls get a job at Casablanca, which is a hostess club in Roppongi. So, Roppongi is the entertainment district there in Tokyo. There are tons of bars, clubs, and restaurants in this area. It was the place to be if you wanted to enjoy the nightlife. It's also super busy with foot traffic. There are people everywhere.
I'm envisioning in my head, like, the shoulder-to-shoulder foot traffic you encounter around Times Square in New York.
Yes, but this is even more people, if you can even believe that. So it's Saturday, July 1st, 2000, and Lucy is on one of her dates that a client has paid for. She calls Louise from a number that's not showing up and says her date had brought her a prepaid cell phone. Now, cell phones were just becoming a thing that people like really had in their pocket and stuff at that time. And they were starting to become a little bit more common for people to have, but most people still had the landlines. So she calls Louise again around 7 that night and says she's at his place, and this is like some seaside place, and would be leaving in about 30 minutes. The two girls had made plans to go dancing and partying once she got home, except Lucy never showed up, and Louise begins to get concerned.
Okay, obviously, don't really know Lucy or her patterns of behavior. So is this something that was typical? Is she known to make plans and then like cancel or blow them off without saying anything?
No, absolutely not. Not at all. And that's one thing that really concerned Louise. And she's also thought it was odd that she got in his car, much less went to his house, because she felt Lucy was much more cautious than that. When she does come home that night, Louise calls her family to tell them that Lucy is missing. She heads to Roppongi and begins looking any place the two of them hung out and places even they didn't hang out, but she's not having any luck at all. She goes to the police to file a missing person report and was told that she was grown and she could be on a date, and besides, she hasn't even been missing a whole 24 hours yet. On Monday, Louise gets a call from a man that says his name is Akia Takagi. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. And was calling for Lucy. And she had met a guru and joined their cult, the newly risen religion. She just wanted to let Louise know that she was alive and well, but would not be returning home. Louise, quickly thinking on her feet and knowing her friend well enough to know this is complete BS, says, "Wow, I want to join the cult too." And he says he will talk to the guru and get back to her.
I love this friend. And if we could all be so lucky to have one just like her. I love that she's thinking under her feet, which in a really stressful situation can be very difficult.
Right. I don't know that I could do that. But Lucy's father, Tim Blackman, started making calls to the Japanese Metropolitan Police as well as the British consulate housed in Japan once he heard the news his daughter was missing. Sadly, this didn't get him far with the language barrier. Her sister Sophia and her ex-boyfriend decided to head to Japan to look for her.
I mean, honestly, in an area this size, and especially because you aren't from there, I don't know what they could really do. But I get you don't want to just sit there and be helpless either. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Right. And they, too, went to the police. But again, this wasn't really something they seemed really interested in and had yet to do anything even after Louise's request for help. Her father decides he needs to fly over and talk with them since he's getting nowhere on the phone. They distribute 30,000 flyers of Lucy, and they put these all over anywhere they can. And they offer a reward of £100,000, which in U.S. dollars is $128,448.73.
Wow, that's a large amount of money that quickly.
Yeah, and this is 2000, too. Just remember that. So, like I said, police are completely unconcerned with this, and her family pleads with them to at least trace the phone call that Louise received. The police inform them that this is against Japanese law and refuse their request. Tim, feeling frustrated and defeated with the police, decides to take it to the media.
This can be very effective if you can get the media to help. I mean, you saw it in the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. We saw that everywhere. But not everyone can get the media to help. So did they end up having any luck?
They actually did. This raises a lot of awareness as to her disappearance and also sheds light on the lack of help they've gotten from the police. So Sir Richard Branson, a British business tycoon, made an appearance asking for information on Lucy. And British Prime Minister Tony Blair was made aware of the situation and spoke to the Japanese Prime Minister, letting them know that the police are not being cooperative in any way. So the police, that they couldn't get to help, now have assigned 80 officers to Lucy's case.
It's so scary when you think about that. You have someone missing in another country. There's language barriers you have to account for. But it's sad that it took all of this rigmarole for them to even take this seriously. Not saying this happens in just other countries. We have this year, right, in the United States, where the police don't always want to investigate the people here, too.
That's true, and especially if you don't have the connections this family had. So while they have all of the officers on this case, they're keeping anything they find out close to the vest, which is really, really frustrating the Blackman family.
Of course, I can understand that, because after all they've gone through, they don't know how serious they're even taking this investigation, I would assume. But on the other hand, if it's anything like the United States, a lot of times they do keep things close to the vest when it's an open investigation. So I get that too.
Yeah. So that's exactly what they think. And Lucy's mother, Jane, ends up hiring a private investigator to look for Lucy. And the PI gets a lead when one of the hostesses at the club describes the man she last saw Lucy leave with. And he gets a sketch artist to work with her, and they get a sketch of the man. He shows the sketch around, but doesn't really have any luck. Her father and sister set up a hotline for people to call for leads. And this does provoke a few leads. Several women that worked as hostesses in various clubs come forward saying they had been on a date with this Japanese man. He took them to dinner and then afterwards to his condo, which was on the seaside. He gave them each a drink and they were soon out with no recollection of what occurred that night. They all described the same man, that he had different names when each of these women described him.
So does he have like some sort of date rape drug? Did any of them go and report this? I realize many don't, since they feel ashamed and probably feel like they can't prove anything, but maybe one of them did.
Some of the girls had actually reported this to the police, but nothing was ever done or looked into to their knowledge. I mean, they can't even get on to look into Lucy's with all the people. So
that's true.
So Tim goes to the police with this, and they decide they will actually pull out those old reports of rape and maybe check into them now. They also have Lord Chancellor Derry Irvine, which is the highest ranking minister in England. He outranks even the prime minister, assisting them. He also was an attorney and at one time taught law. So he informs the Japanese authorities that tracing Lucy's last call is not technically illegal, and they do finally trace that call.
I don't want to state the obvious, but laws in England and laws in Japan are not the same. So how you get someone from another country to interpret your law and then convince you that it's fine to do this, I guess he's a very persuasive person. He's got that attorney charm, I guess. Yes.
And I need this man if I'm ever on trial. But thank God he was good at his job, because this led them to Joji Urbara. Who is this guy anyway? So his birth name was Kim Sung Jong, and he was born in 1952, and he's actually Korean. And his parents started out very poor. His father was a taxi driver, but saved money to buy his own taxis until he owned a whole fleet of them. He then used the money to invest what we call here in America, casinos. And I don't know how long all this took him, but by the time Joji was 15, he was enrolled in prep school. His parents bought him a home in Tokyo, complete with a maid. He studied law in Tokyo and politics at Keio University. And then in 1969, his father passed away while in Hong Kong under suspicious circumstance. was all I was able to find out, and not the actual cause of death either.
Hi, I'm Ashley, a true crime fanatic.
I'm Dan, and I don't know anything about true crime.
Together, we host Fuck That, a true crime podcast that covers cases that highlight important topics that are often overlooked, such as wrongful convictions, domestic violence, and social inequities, sprinkled in with the occasional case with spooky themes. If you are looking for your next true crime fix delivered candidly with a hint of sarcasm, you can listen and subscribe to bi-weekly episodes of Fuck That wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to give us a follow on Facebook and Twitter at FThatPod and at FThat_pod on Instagram.
So was there anything as to why they thought it was suspicious?
All I could find is that the authorities believed that he was in bed with some underworld businessman with the casinos. And I have to assume they think some bad businesses deals had gone wrong or something to that effect. So this left Joji and his two brothers very well off. This is when he changes his name and moves to Japan. Joji invested well in real estate, and he thought he did. At one point, his assets were estimated at $38 million, U.S. dollars. He'd made good money, and he spent it even better. And this put him in debt, and his mother had to bail him out at one point. But don't worry, he got to keep all of his fancy cars and assets.
Oh, thank God. I was very concerned.
Yes, I knew you were. So they arrest Joji, and he admits to nothing. The police search his home, and they hit pay dirt. They find tons of videotapes that Joji has made over the course of 18 years. This isn't Sweet Home videos we're talking about either. This is him raping unconscious women. If the women begin to act as if they're coming to, he had a rag there with chloroform. He would knock them back out again. They find a huge amount of pharmaceutical drugs and chloroform. The police view the tapes and find there are over 200 women that he had videoed. One being Cardia Ridgway. Not only that, he has journals with over 200 women where he describes the rapes. And by Cardia, he also left himself a note that he had used too much chloroform.
Okay, this is giving me like Russell Williams vibes, maybe because we did an episode on him recently. Maybe it's the serial rapist thing, but you don't keep damning evidence against you. So, I don't know.
Yeah, that's weird. So, they probably didn't listen to enough true crime podcasts, is my guess. Well, of course, they didn't, since this wasn't a thing then. But, I mean, if they had...
They didn't have time anyway, where they were too busy committing crimes.
Yeah, that's true. So, going back to Carita... We talked about the fact that the hospital wouldn't share anything about the autopsy. And of course, they can't resume her body because, of course, she was cremated. But for whatever reason, they had kept a sample of her liver.
That seems a little sketch, to be honest.
Yeah, it totally does. But thankfully, they did this because they have her liver tested and it shows traces of chloroform. So they also view all these videos and had hoped. Well, that's probably a bad choice of words, but assumed they would see Lucy on one of them. But after reviewing them all, she's not on any of these videotapes. And I just want to say I'm really sorry for whoever had to watch all the videos. They didn't stop looking. They find a roll of film that has pictures of Lucy on them. They get his phone records, and on July 2nd, he had called several local hospitals. They also see in his computer history he had searched on how to dispose of a body and sulfuric acid.
Okay, that doesn't look good, but also, in all fairness, my internet searches probably don't look much better than that.
Right. So please know I'm not a serial killer, nor am I trying to commit murder or of any kind, but just in case someone looks at mine, yeah, it looks the same. So it took 7 months, but they find a bathtub turned over upside down on the beach near his condo. They flip it over and there are 8 plastic bags, which, who does that remind you of? Bit of Dexter, except they're not at the bottom of them.
Right.
So when they open these bags, they find various body parts of Lucy. Not only has he dismembered her body and threw her out like trash, but he took her head and put it in a block and covered it in cement. they were able to confirm it was Lucy with her dental records. He ends up being charged with 8 cases of rape. The murder of Cardia and Lucy, he pleads not guilty to all of them. Now, I can't find out why he was only charged with 8 rapes. I don't know if they may have, had passed the statute of limitations. But I don't even know if they have that in Japan, but if they had it passed, this is just my speculation and in no way fact. So it's not until April of 2007 that he's found guilty on all counts of rape and the murder of Cardia, but not of Lucy. They say they don't have a jury there, but a panel of 3 judges, and the judges felt like this was just circumstantial evidence of the murder of Lucy. So he did still receive a life sentence. While knowing he's in prison for life may have been enough justice for some, it wasn't for Lucy's family. They hated the fact that he was acquitted on the murder charges and appealed the decision. So in December of 2008, he was found guilty of kidnapping and dismembering a body as well as concealing the body, but not for the murder. They took this as somewhat of a win and they didn't appeal further.
Okay. I have some thoughts, but first, so we're going to say he kidnapped her. We're going to say that he cut her up. We're going to say that he hid the body. But no, I don't think he murdered her. I don't think there's not enough evidence for that, but he definitely kidnapped her. He definitely cut her up after she was dead. Definitely hid her body. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's wild to me because, had the police taken any of these hostages, allegations of rape seriously, maybe neither one of these women would have died, and it could have saved so many others from being raped. It sounds like how a lot of people view, a lot of police view sex workers here, though. It gives me, the same vibe.
Yeah, it did me, too. And this could have saved many, but I do want to say that there are a lot convicted of rape, or if you were convicted of rape there in Japan, you may have only gotten 2 years for that. And this may not have even been enough to stop him. But it would have been enough to at least hopefully slow him down.
Let's hope so. But at least now he is stopped and in prison forever.
True.
We always recommend more bubbly
and less OJ.
Cheers! If you'd like to see pictures from today's episode, you can find us at murder.mimosas on Instagram. You can also find us at murder.mimosas on TikTok, Twitter. And if you have a case you would like us to do, you can send that to murder.mimosas@gmail.com. And lastly, we are on Facebook at Murder and Mimosas Podcast, where you can interact with us there. We love any type of feedback you can give us, so please rate and review us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.